calm, cool, collective, laid back, reserved. That's him. So because of that, he doesn't apply pressure to himself.
The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
David Bowe's in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Jeez, that Olympia story about the cat kind of freaks me out. It's like something out of Criminal Minds or something. The little cat found, just the head of the cat found on top of the chain link fence. When I first heard about it, I thought, well, maybe it's a coyote, because people do sometimes confuse coyotes that have eaten pets, cats, as possible mutilation because of the way they, you know, tear apart the animal or whatever. But when it's on top of a chain link fence with a missing cat poster posted right above it, you know it's a human being. And the best you can hope for is that the cat was already dead and was roadkill, and that's what happened. But instead, you end up thinking, you know, of some budding would-be future extremely violent individual committing all kinds of torture and harm on a poor little animal. And it's pretty horrifying. In fact, you know, when the sheriff's office saying, you know, before he does something really bad, I think, and well, before he does something a whole lot worse. And I know I'm saying he, which, you know, you might say I'm being gender biased there, but there's a reason for that. And that's because most of the time this kind of violent behavior is guys, frankly. It's just men do this kind of thing and it's horrible. I should say males, because it could be a minor. And unrelated to the other cat killer in the area, which they've got two cat mutilators in the area in Thurston County. You know, that's not going to help with the tourism advertising at this point or home prices. You know, come to Thurston County. We've got a big cat mutilator problem. They've got a reward out for the Thurston County cat killer up to $53,000 now. Not found. It's really disturbing that that's an unrelated thing. So hopefully that individual will be found. And if they're a minor, hopefully they can get the psychological help they need before they ruin their lives and the lives of everybody around them. Just horrible stuff. All right, let's move on to happier things, or at least less awful things. Let's head on over to the Big Lead.
The Big Lead, big local.
King County allowed ICE to access jail inmates' personal information many, many, many times. King County Auditor's Office spokesperson Megan Coe describes how many times ICE accessed that information.
Over the course of 1 year, 15 employees of ICE's detention and removal unit logged into a county system more than 1,000 times.
They were able to see photos, physical descriptions, addresses, aliases for more than 40,000 bookings into the King County jails. With photos and addresses, the federal agents can more easily identify and locate people, potentially leading to the detention or removal of county residents, according to the report from the county auditor. Northwest Immigrant Rights Project's Baron. I honestly don't know.
I believe it's Jorge.
Is it Jorge? I just don't know how he prefers to have it pronounced. He wants to know what happened.
I still want to see the details of exactly what happened, but I think I'm disappointed, is how it captured. My concern is what other, you know, areas have we not looked at where information may be being shared contrary to the policy that we set, you know, here as law.
Now, in some cases, according to the Seattle Times, jail officials also collected citizenship information that was ostensibly to notify foreign consulates that their citizens were detained, but the information was not obtained with informed consent and could be subject to a data breach, according to the report. In addition, the county sheriff's office gave ICE 24 unredacted case files between January of 2018 and May of 2019, according to the report. The revelations highlight the disconnect between policy and practice unknown even to top officials, never mind the people affected. Now, this is from the Seattle Times report. I found that to be a strange sentence. Let me read that again. The revelations highlight the sometimes stunning disconnect between policy and practice, unknown even to top officials, never mind the people affected. I find that to be like an op-ed in the middle of the story. Am I wrong there? No, I don't think so. Anyway, here's what confuses me. Why are people so upset about information being shared with ICE when it comes to the bookings in jail? You know, I thought that was the one area where everybody could agree if there's information to be shared, people are being booked into jail. You know, and people are also here illegally, but there's also crimes being committed, then that's the kind of sharing that you would want. But apparently not. Not without a court order, according to this. Jorge Barron, the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project called the revelations, quote, profoundly disappointing and disturbing. And I'm wondering if the majority of people find that information that maybe I'm wrong. I mean, maybe there's some implications here that I'm unaware of. But I feel like most people, if they hear that information according of jail bookings is being shared with ICE, I think that's where the concern is least. Right? It's not like it's social services or schools or something along those lines. This is people are getting booked into jail, and the immigration authorities were looking at that information. My bet is that the majority of people are not in the outraged category there. I think the majority of people are going to say, well, yeah, well, that part I wasn't worried about. I was worried about some of the other things that might disrupt lives, like, you know, school zone information where people have American kids and their parents are here illegally and I don't want the family separated. But, you know, if dad or mom is committing crimes and they're in the jail system and they're also here illegally, which, by the way, is statistically rare, then I think people would, most people would say, okay, that I can live with. I wonder what an initiative would be like in the state if you were to say, all right, you can't share information, but jail systems can, or law enforcement, they can share that information. My bet is it would pass pretty solidly. I'm guessing. You know, I haven't done a poll, but I'm guessing that most people see the distinction of the two and would be just fine with it. Anyway, if you disagree, you can text us on the Online Trading Academy text line. Let's go to Big Lead number two.
The Big Lead, Big Local.
The Washington State is suing the Navy over expansion of Growler jet training on Whidbey Island. State Attorney General Bob Ferguson seems like he hasn't found a federal government aspect that he doesn't like to sue, says the Navy's failed to conduct required surveys on how these increased flights might affect people and local wildlife.
Fully consider the impacts of significant decisions that will impact Washingtonians and our environment before finalizing those decisions. The law requires that process. In other words, the Navy needs to look before it leaps. They did not do that here. Specifically, the Navy violated the National Environmental Policy Act. We'll refer to that probably as NEPA throughout this conversation, and the Administrative Procedure Act, often called the APA.
Okay, so he says the Navy just added these extra jets. They're going to make extra noise. It's a complete disaster. It's going to harm the eagles, the bald eagles, which, by the way, have proliferated amazingly. I mean, there's bald eagles everywhere now. Also, I see them frequently near freeways. Have you noticed that? I mean, I see eagles all the time. I see nests built near freeways from time to time, you know. So it seems like noise isn't their big thing. But, you know, I'm more worried about the orcas and the ships and the Puget Sound than I am the noise and the eagles. Anyway, he says that the Navy should have looked before it leaped. But Navy Public Affairs said the Navy completed a thorough and comprehensive environmental impact statement that addressed all the comments received during a six-year period. And so I thought, 6 years? They've been studying this issue for 6 years? And that's supposed to be they're not looking before they leap? The Growler aircraft jams communication and launch systems and is a frontline force in the U.S. military electromagnetic warfare. The Navy currently has 82 Growlers in Oak Harbor that approved an expansion of 36 more. Now, I understand why people who live in the area, it might be disturbed because the jets can be noisy. I have some from JBLM fly over my house from time to time, and it is a noise. Rob Smith, Northwest Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, says it's simply not an acceptable place to have so many jets. It's a bad problem, and it's getting worse. Critics like Smith said more training could be conducted at other sites in the western United States, and the lawsuit seeks a judgment that the Navy has violated the National Environmental Policy Act and other federal laws by relying on a legally deficient environmental review. I feel like a six-year environmental review is enough. You've got the Navy's already there with multiple jets. Things seem to be going pretty well for all birds considered. There's economic and defense realities here, and then just sending the problem elsewhere. How's that supposed to help things? I don't quite understand how that's going to be better for the birds. It's kind of like the Yucca Mountain situation where there's been millions and millions and millions of dollars of the best minds in the nation studying how to get rid of nuclear waste. That place is Yucca Mountain, but they don't want it. And they say, hey, send it somewhere else, which, you know, I don't necessarily blame them, but there does come a point where you say, well, we've got the naval bases here. They're reliant on us. They're a key aspect of the economy. I think JBLM is like what? Employer, the military's second largest employer in Washington State, or third, depending on how you're counting. So it's a huge economic impact. And I'm guessing in Island County, the Navy base there is by far number one when it comes to economic impact. So I'm not sure suing them over this is the best strategy long term, particularly since every once in a while they'll look at these things and see, all right, you know, when it comes to base shutdowns, would it be better for everybody if they just went away? Which brings us to
the big lead update.
So we had that minimum wage law situation where major restaurateurs were closing down. A Seattle restaurant chain declared bankruptcy, and they cited the minimum wage, the higher minimum wage, as one of the issues that is causing their closure. And we talked about that a little bit, I think it was yesterday, here on the Drory Monson Show. Well, Danny Westney now says in his latest column, he says, hold on, minimum wage played a part regarding these restaurants. Well, if that's how is that possible? Because, he says here, dinner was fine at Stanford's outside the Northgate Mall, he said, until the bill arrived, because on it was tacked a 4.9% LWGSC, which is a living wage surcharge added to offset the cost of the minimum wage. He said this is not for services provided and is not paid directly to the service staff or our guests. He says, well, who is it being paid to then? His reaction now is this is a company that's making a big political statement that it can't afford to pay the increased wages of its workers. But that sneaky fee it charged me at the end of the meal was supposedly to pay the increased wages of its workers. So where did all that money go if it wasn't paying for the increased wages? He says. He says the wage hikes, the company said in its Restaurants Unlimited joints around town, the company's bankruptcy filing made the wage hikes have significantly increased our labor costs and have had a serious impact on the economics of the business, the company said in a statement. And he writes, okay, but how much money did the living wage charges bring in? They don't say. He hasn't been back to Stanford's, partly because he thought the approach was heavy-handed, and he didn't like that. But I would say this. The fact that they collected the living wage surcharge doesn't negate it doesn't mean that their assertion that the increased minimum wage was a harm to their business, that the cost of the minimum wage harmed their business, because ultimately they had to pass it on to the customers. Now, they did it as an isolated isolated line item. Otherwise, it would have been, you know, directly into the food. But by isolating the line item, they are making a bit of a political statement. But what happens is when food becomes too expensive, or when any item becomes larger expensive, people look for replacements. So let's say you have an increase in the price of a steak at this particular restaurant, and their business plan was to be an affordable place for people to go out to eat and sit down, but it reaches a tipping point where for a lot of their customer base, now it's expensive enough so if they aren't going to go out, they're not going to go there. They're going to go to a cheaper place. Say if they're going to sit down now, they're going to go to, you know, a takeout teriyaki place and sit down or whatever. So the increase of the price, even if they're not paying it directly and they're passing it on to the consumers, it still harms the business model. They didn't say it was the only reason they were going bankrupt. They said this was one of the reasons why, and that it was harmful to their business model. So, you know, just like if you are McDonald's and you've got your value menu and people are going to McDonald's because they want cheap food, but let's say some rule or some tax on it makes it so that the burgers at McDonald's are now pretty close to the price of Red Robin, which would you go to at that point? You know, McDonald's, their whole value structure is built on being super fast, easy, and cheap. And if they're not cheap, then people are going to look for something else or just not go, or they'll go to, you know, Taco Bell or somewhere else for the fast food. But I don't think that just because they pass the charge on, that it negates the fact that the larger minimum wage ends up being a fact in their bankruptcy. Westney also points out that the Congressional Budget Office has a study showing that the effects of the $15, $12, and $10 minimum wages, that there are pros and cons, and that some people will experience major benefits, higher wages, more stability at the bottom of the economic ladder, whereas others will lose loss of jobs, loss of working hours in certain industries. And that's the whole problem is once you get the mandate in there, yes, nobody's saying that nobody will benefit. There's always some people who will benefit. The problem is for those who don't, there's no flexibility. And if the economy turns down and you've got, say, an industry or a restaurant or various entrepreneurs that need flexibility, they don't have it anymore. And that can also harm the employees there as well. So the biggest lesson of all is that the real minimum wage is zero. And so you, when you're dealing with a minimum wage issue, you need to talk about it in that way so that you remind yourself that there can be real consequences that can impact people in a harsh way. And you should be leery of that before having a third party decide how much somebody else can afford to pay for their business or their business model.
The Big Lead, Big Local.
Hateful flyers are out linked to a neo-Nazi group that were pinned outside Kirkland and Kenmore churches. The words from the flyers claimed censorship ends in violence. They're written across the top of a flyer. And the center was a picture of the Christchurch shooter, the gunman responsible for the attack on Muslims during Friday prayers in Christchurch, New Zealand. The massacre ended in the death of 51 people and was broadcast live on Facebook. They also have a badge used to single out the Jewish community. It covers the gunman's mouth with the words, quote, "Refugees, welcome to hell," are written. Bottom of the flyer are words, quote, "Increase free speech and increase the peace," brought to you by your local Stormer Book Club, the SBC. Pastor Anja Hellman of Northlake Lutheran noted that the Stormer Book Club website offers a disclaimer that they do not promote any violence, but she's unsure of how closely members of the neo-Nazi group would follow that message. I would submit that when you send out a message that is this closely and clearly violent in its nature, that the disclaimer is a crock meant to probably scare away lawsuits or try to diminish the possibility of lawsuits. Remember that the nut jobs in Hayden Lake, the white supremacists there, they lost their compound in Idaho because they were violent and threatened other people, and ultimately they were sued and found responsible, and they had to get out of Dodge, much to the benefit of Northern Idaho. So these two churches were threatened. Who knows why they were specifically targeted? It looks like, you know, this club is super creepy, super dangerous. And it's whenever I see something like this, I just wonder, in this day and era, with all the information out there, how is it possible that people still join an organization like that? What is it that you look when you look at, say, the growing, you know, biracial and multiracial components of America, the enormous accomplishments, the high tech world and everything else? What possible Neanderthalic point of view would lead you in the direction of anybody who would distribute flyers of that kind? David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson on 97.3 Cairo FM. It is stunning how nobody is able to drive in the Tacoma area. I mean, I don't know what's wrong. I've lived in Tacoma now for over a decade. Every single day, Fife is a mess. And it's flat and straight, and there's nothing there. And now you've got, some new detours with the roads. And they've been working on the roads there for, well, at least 13 years, because I've been there. And so you should expect that the signage is going to change, right? It's not really that difficult right now. It's not like there's a sharp 90-degree turn on I-5. The speed limit's down to 50 miles an hour. And when you're going through Fife, it's almost impossible to get going much faster than that anyway up the hill. But there is this kind of attitude of not letting anybody over. You know, like you turn on your turn signal and everybody acts like that's the worst thing in the world because they're going to get stuck behind you. And if you just think of the zipper effect, you know, and let one car ahead and just let it always have that one space. Let the cars get in and move around and then you're fine. But man, that's frustrating. I know how that is. I'm just glad I'm not on my way home right now because sounds like it's going to be a mess for a while. But right now we've got to get to something spectacular. That's Awesome Audio.
This is Dory Monson's Awesome Audio. Clips of the day.
One of the great stories over the past few days has been the fact that an experience of one couple, John and Phyllis Cook, shows that love is always a possibility. NBC Ohio has a story about a couple who waited a while to get married, a long while.
At 100 and 102 years old, John and Phyllis Cook took a trip to the courthouse on Wednesday. Well, did they know the Cooks would walk out a married couple.
Congratulations, you two.
Thank you.
John and Phyllis Cook were the talk of the Kingston residents in Sylvania on Thursday.
That was the happy couple.
There we go.
The two had been dating for about a year when they went to get their marriage license on Wednesday. They ended up just having their wedding right there.
Wasn't a plan, but we got there and they said, well, we could marry you here. And I said, well, good, let's get it over with.
The two lovebirds each lost two spouses. John is a World War II veteran that recently turned 100 years old. Phyllis, originally from West Virginia, will turn 103 on August 8th, which is still 3 years shy of how old her mother lived to be. Their relationship blossomed over the past months, and as a devout Christian woman, Phyllis decided it was best to tie the knot.
Tell you the truth, we fell in love with each other. I know you think that may be a little bit far-fetched for somebody our age, but we fell in love with each other.
Well, we just were compatible in a lot of ways and found ourselves, you know, enjoying each other's company.
The Cooks spend their days with each other in the assisted living facility, enjoying eating meals and sitting out in the sun. Despite spending hours together every day, they understand the importance of their space.
Well, we do. We kept both of our apartments. He's upstairs and I'm down.
Their age is certainly not a factor in their romance. There is still a big spark when they spend time with one another. I asked John what their favorite thing to do together was. His response?
Well, I probably shouldn't talk about that.
That's just the best. Great story. Can't help but smile when you're listening to it. Happy for them. You know, people, they're that age. What's shocking is they waited a year to get married because, you know, after you reach a certain age, you know, the actuarial tables will say your life expectancy is always 6 months, you know, because basically you're on your way and they're living till the end, which is a beautiful thing when you think about it. And congratulations to them. I hope they live many, many happy years together and are able to live that happy. I like the fact that they've got separate apartments, too. That also just cracked me up. It's like, let's keep things happy, but let's make sure I don't have to hear him snore. That's great stuff. And that brings us to
number two.
Downtown Seattle is a very safe location, but incidents like this really shake people. They hurt people, and we want to make sure that we're dealing with that.
That's the mayor of Seattle describing how Seattle is safe, despite the fact that outside of Nordstrom, there was an individual who had been arrested at least, and I emphasize the words at least, 22 times prior, who had stabbed three people in the middle of downtown. And she wants to remind everybody that Seattle is safe. However, we would point out that this guy's been free 22 times, has multiple arrests for things like assault, and he's, again, in the middle of downtown, stabbing himself first, then stabbing three other people before stripping naked and running away and being followed and police catching up with him, possibly because his disguise wasn't the best. But he gets arrested, and she's telling us that the downtown is safe. Downtown is safe even though violent crime is on the rise throughout the state, and I'm guessing in Seattle particularly. The Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs released its 2018 crime report in Washington on Tuesday. It showed that while property crimes were down a bit, assault, murder, and rape were up 4.3%. Drug and weapon violations were up 6.9%. Assaults against law enforcement officers are up 40%. So you be the judge. Do you think Seattle's a safe place, or do you think we've got some extra challenges that we should be aware of? And then We come to the loss of a great comedian, a great character actor, whose name you might not recognize. Rip Torn. Almost sounds like a fake action hero's name. Rip Torn. In fact, the first time I looked at the credits, I thought there was a mistake. When I saw his name, I thought he was I thought they were just putting some kind of stage name or whatever, but apparently he liked that name. He stuck with it. It was a family nickname. He passed away at the age of 88. He was probably most famous for his role as the producer Artie on The Larry Sanders Show, but he was also an accomplished dramatic actor. And Chris says he was in some junk as well. I say he was in some classics, like Mark Singer's Beastmaster.
I'm a snow.
You will die at the hands of Zed's unborn son.
Zed's unborn son will die.
The truth cannot be changed.
You can die tonight.
You probably don't recognize any of that, but Chris is right. Occasionally, he would just star in the worst junk. But he's a classic guy, and you would recognize him as the character Don Geiss, who owned General Electric on the show 30 Rock.
Don.
Jack, you old dog, how are you?
I'm good, sir.
Of course you are. Look at those eyes, sharp like a panther's.
Thank you, sir. Would you like to sit down?
I can't. I took my grandkids snorkeling at St. Bart's and got stung by a jellyfish. I got a welt on my ass the size of a red delicious apple.
I'm very sorry to hear that, sir.
Now, he was most famous for being kind of a tough, blowhard kind of guy. Artie, the producer he played on The Larry Sanders Show, he played a similar kind of character as he did with on 30 Rock as Don Geiss, kind of the super powerful businessman. And he had this very distinctive voice and delivery. He said he played comedy like a drama and drama like a comedy was the key to his acting. He died at the age of 88, although if you saw him, you'd guess he was younger. Just another one of those guys that just was pretty darn active until the very end, and rest in peace for him. We've got the end of the world signs coming up on the Dory Monson Show. David Bowe's filling in. Oh, an awesome audio brought to you by Brown Bear Car Wash. I was just there. Great stuff. David Bowe's in for Dory Monson on 97.3 Cairo FM. It's the last segment of the show, last part of the day for the Dory Monson Show, which leads us to...
today's sign that the end is near.
And what a sign it is. You know, you're trying to do your best for the environment, so you take out your eco-friendly metal drinking straw so you're not causing any harm, not using a plastic cup or anything. You take it out, you start to enjoy your mason jar style drinking glass with the screw top lid, walking around your kitchen, drinking your favorite beverage. Next thing you know, you trip and fall. Well, that's what happened to Elena Struthers Gardner, a 60-year-old known as Lena. She fell and then impaled herself on the metal eco-friendly straw, which was not so human-friendly. The 10-inch stainless steel straw entered the left eye socket and killed her. Fatally impaled by the eco-friendly metal straw. Now, advice from the coroner, Brendan Allen. Great care should be taken when using these metal straws. There's no give in them at all. If someone does fall on one and it's pointed in the wrong direction, serious injury can occur. It seems to him that these metal straws should not be used with any form of lid that holds them in place. So there's that. I actually just used one of those recyclable straws. It's a paper straw. And it turned into a strange, slimy substance, you know, within, say, a quarter of my beverage, which leads me to believe you still need the good old-fashioned plastic straw. And the next time somebody gives you trouble, just tell them about the person in England who died using the eco-friendly straw. Next up, deputies found a 57-year-old Texas man. They were looking for a fellow in Johnson County. They went to a trailer home searching for Freddie Mac, who hadn't been seen or heard from and from their relatives since April 19th. So on May 6th, they showed up at the trailer park to perform a welfare check, but they couldn't get there. Why? Because Freddie Mac had so many dogs, 18 to be precise, 18 dogs guarding his property. They couldn't get close to the trailer to check on the man. So ultimately, they started distracting the dogs, and they were able to search part of that property. On May 9th, they returned after the missing persons report became official, and they were able to They were able to stop some of the dogs, but again, they couldn't get inside because of the aggressive nature of the dogs. So they had to go back on May 15th. They searched again the property looking for this man. A detective noticed a small piece of bone on the ground. You can see where this is going. 2 days later, detectives executed a search warrant, located the piece of bone and several other bone fragments. They were sent to the ME's office, medical examiner's office, and they needed to perform a thorough search of the property because the bones belonged to Mr. Mack. The 16 dogs were seized on May 19th. I don't know why they left two. I guess two must have escaped or something. Anyway, they found strips of cloth, animal feces containing bone fragments, suspected human hair and fabric. Mr. Mack was known to wear a single set of clothing and did not own any other sets. That's not something you read very often. So here's a guy with 18 dogs, one piece of clothing that he owned, and apparently he was consumed by the dogs. Because they didn't know whether the dogs killed him or just ate him after he died, they euthanized all the dogs, particularly due to their extremely aggressive nature, which, again, all of this spells a failure on the part of Texas to figure out what was going on, both with the animals, which is clearly inhumane, and with this individual who's clearly suffering some kind of mental trauma. I don't know why the family even, I mean, at some point, if the guy has one pair of clothes and nobody's checked on him for that long and he goes missing, the whole thing is super creepy and a sign of perhaps the end of the world. But it could be worse. In fact, just thinking about the city of Seattle, you know, we were concerned about the safety of downtown Seattle and the mayor claiming that everything's fine.
Downtown Seattle is a very safe location.
And, you know, maybe we're mad at her for that, but maybe she has a point. It could be worse. After all, we could be in Colombia, where a Colombian bishop is planning to perform an exorcism for the entire city. The city is beset by violence, drug smuggling, and poverty. The Monsignor Ruben de Jaro Yamarmio Montoya, that reminds me of the Princess Bride there, the Bishop of Buenaventura, is going to perform a prayer intended to purge the entire city of demonic infestation. And before you laugh it off and say, well, that can't possibly be true, the city is struggling from violence, beheadings, the carving up of people, drug smuggling, and poverty. And a 10-year-old girl was tortured and murdered. So that's why it's happening. He's going to go over a military helicopter, sprinkle holy water in the city, and perform a ritual. I hope it works. It's a nightmare. And finally, a robot started a fire that cost Ocado, which is the British equivalent of Amazon, $137 million. It's a home delivery robot. Ended up causing a house fire because of battery misfunction, leading us to believe that Skynet is upon us via grocery delivery. So be careful of that. David Bowes in for Dory Monson, 97.3 Cairo FM.
I will not have this in my studio. You have failed conclusively. It's over. And there is nothing that you can do here in this room that can turn that around. Nothing you can do that can make up for what you just did.